On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For months, as Republicans have slid in the polls, Democrat hopes for taking back Congress have focused on the House, where first 15, then 20, and now maybe 35 Republican seats appear vulnerable. But in recent weeks, even the GOP majority in the U.S. Senate looks up for grabs. Six seats would move the Senate majority from the R to the D column. Republicans are fighting hard. But a Wall Street Journal NBC poll this week finds voter approval of Congress at an epic low 16%. That is a hard tide to fight. We will hear in this hour from Missouri, Tennessee, New Jersey, and Montana. We begin in Washington with Janet Hook, political correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She's been out on the hustings watching races up close. Janet, thanks very much for being with us today.
Sure, Tom.
Good to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you, my friend.
Hello, Tom, and a very warm welcome to you, Janet. Nice to have you on the show.
Janet, we know you've been right out there all over the place and watching these numbers. What is the big picture as we sit here now less than 3 weeks from Election Day? What's it look like in this contest for control of the Senate?
Well, it's interesting because for some time now, people have been thinking that it was pretty likely or that the Democrats had a really good shot of winning control of the House. And the Senate has always seemed a little bit more out of reach.
Yeah.
And that's largely because a lot of the most contested Senate races are in conservative, you know, Bush-leaning states. But as we've gotten closer and closer to the election, what I think once seemed almost unthinkable now seems possible, certainly not a slam dunk still. But as you say, there are a lot of these contested races are getting closer and closer. And in fact, Democrats, some of the Democratic candidates are even getting ahead of their Republican incumbents.
Take us right down to the bone here. What are the races that are now most in play? We're reading about very fluid strategies in the GOP and on the Democratic side. The GOP had some candidates who they thought were good shots. They were pouring money into, now maybe redirecting money as those don't look so good. What are the key swing votes look like at this point?
Well, right now, I mean, if you want to start with the three states that seem most likely for the Republicans to lose, that they're Pennsylvania, where Rick Santorum has been struggling against Bob Casey for a long time now, Rhode Island, where Lincoln Chafee, a moderate Republican in a very Democratic state, is in a lot of trouble, and Montana, where Conrad Burns has been struggling because of his connection with the Jack Abramoff scandal. So right there are three seats that the Democrats are hoping to get.
Now, the Democrats need six to take a majority. What are the others in play here?
Well, the others in play, I'd say the four most hotly contested right now are Missouri, which we'll be talking about, Tennessee, Ohio, and Virginia.
What happened in Ohio? Mike DeWine, money gone away, we're told. Why? What's the dynamic there?
Well, I think there's a big debate going on among Republicans about, you know, how much to continue committing to Ohio. I think, you know, saying that they've written off Mike DeWine goes too far. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of money in Mike DeWine's campaign and a lot of interest in staying behind it, if only because Ohio is such an important state. Generally, there are a lot of other important races, competitive House races and a gubernatorial race. But Mike DeWine has been running in the double digits behind his Democratic opponent, Sherrod Brown. And the political climate in Ohio is particularly bad for Republicans because of state-related ethics scandals. So, you know, all of the Republicans there are really treading water.
We're going to turn to Missouri in just a moment. Jack Beattie, big picture. What do you see going on in this race for control of half the Hill?
Well, you know, these Republican Senate candidates have been dealt a bad hand, and that hand is Iraq. Again and again in these debates, they say, stay the course. And yet yesterday in Iraq, we saw what that course is. The government ordered the Americans to release a man who had a sheik who had planned attacks against Americans. If that starts to register, if that course starts to register on the voters, that the course is protecting a government that is not friendly to us, that is, that, you know, that really is supported by Shiite militia, That's a tough hand. And already you can see that Bush is starting to move away from the war. At least he's got James Baker out there ready to give him some cover with his commission after the election. You've got John Warner giving these people some cover, saying we're going to give them 30, 60 days or 90 days. And yet that's not what these candidates are saying. They're saying, stay the course, stay the course. It's a very tough hand.
Let's jump right into one of these races. I want to go to St. Louis, and Joe Manis, a political correspondent for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She's covering the Missouri Senate race between Republican incumbent Jim Talent and Democratic challenger Claire McCaskill. Joe, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for asking me, Tom.
So where does it stand at this point? We've still got almost 3 weeks, but what does it look like, first of all, just in the polls? Who's ahead?
Well, all the polls have shown it really too close to call. There have been a few of the latest polls that have given her a very slight lead, and some of us think that may be the case, or at least that got the Talent people nervous, which is why during Monday night's debate, which was their fourth, they also did one last night in Kansas City, he switched tactics and got much more aggressive than he had been in previous debates. But that said, frankly, all of our polls by our newspaper have shown it too close to call. We will be doing another one before Election Day, but a lot of it's going to depend, as in these other closely held states, on voter turnout, and that is definitely the situation here. It's a midterm election, and it's going to depend on who turns out, and the Republicans generally have had a better ground game in Missouri the last two elections at doing that.
So there's a big machine waiting to kick in on the GOP side. Let's listen back to a little bit of that debate from Monday night in Springfield, Missouri. Democratic challenger Claire McCaskill and Republican incumbent Jim Talent speaking about Iraq. Here's Claire McCaskill questioned and answering first.
Instead of worrying about the men and women who are dying right now, men like the young man from Lebanon that just died last week, we are worried about winning elections, about being stubborn and a foreign policy that's not working. We need to redeploy our troops over a two-year time period and into Afghanistan, where the Taliban has resurfaced, into other areas of the Middle East so that we can respond to terrorist attacks if they arise. It's time to make the Iraqi people stand up for themselves.
Senator Talent, you now have 1 minute and 30 seconds to answer that question.
Well, thank you for the question, Dave. Well, we're not going to win victories if we leave, which is what my opponent wants to do. Look, here was the mission in Iraq. It was to what we've done is we've replaced Saddam Hussein. We've created a government of national unity, a democracy there. We've trained up an effective 130,000 person Iraqi army. We need to finish the job, complete the mission, and then come home with a victory in our pocket. It'll be a tremendous victory in the overall war on terror and all the fronts. What we have to do is continue seasoning and sizing the Iraqi army properly so they can defend themselves. And when we've done that, they won't need large numbers of American troops anymore, and we'll be able to come home.
Republican Jim Talent up against Democrat Claire McCaskill there in debate this week in Springfield, Missouri. Joe Manis, how is Iraq playing? Is the national agenda, the Iraq agenda piece of it at least, number one in this race, or where does it sit?
Well, in every poll that we've done over the past year, Iraq has been the number one issue. And a majority of the people that we have polled, I'd say at least since the beginning of the year, have indicated that they no longer think it was worth it to have gone into Iraq. But that said, there is a strong passion among those who feel that now we're there, we need to stay there. So when you interview people on the street, there is arguably equally as much passion among those who want us to stay the course as it is among those who want us to leave now or very soon. And that, particularly in a midterm, as I mentioned before, mm-hmm. is one of the key elements, because it's the people with passion who will get to the polls on November 7th, and that's true in Missouri as in many other states. And I think that's one of the reasons that Talent, while he has tried to distance himself from the president in some regards, if the president had come in and helped him raise several million dollars within the last year and a half, but when the president was here last week, Talent didn't appear with him. Talent instead campaigned with his wife, Laura Bush, who was here on some separate events. Even though he's done all that, Talent has stuck very tight with the line that we need to stay the course. And in part, he is directing those comments toward the passionate people within his own party who he really needs to turn out to the polls. One of the reasons he chose Springfield to change his tactics and become more aggressive is because Springfield is in southwest Missouri, and that is the heartland, the touchstone, if you will, for the Republican Party in the state. John Ashcroft came from that part of the state. A lot of the major Republicans came from that part of the state, and that has a huge Republican majority there, and they need them to turn out in huge numbers on Election Day.
If they don't, they could have
problems because they're not doing as well in the suburbs as they would like.
Turning to conservative country in the home stretch in a very tight race, Joe Manny is with St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Joe, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Janet, we've just got you for another minute. What are you going to be looking for in this final two-plus weeks?
Well, you know, it really is hand-to-hand combat. It's state-by-state. It's district-by-district. I think you pointed to one important development, one important thing to watch for is sort of where the parties choose to make their last stand. You know, if you've got six contested Senate races and a limited amount of money, I don't know if Republicans are going to have to at some point say, okay, we're going to have to give up on Ohio or whatever state and pour into Missouri. Right now, money doesn't seem to be the object. Time and the political climate is the biggest obstacle.
And whose side is time on at this point as it ticks down?
You know, I don't know. Maybe it's on the Republican side in this sense, is if the election were held today, it would really be bad news for them. And I think their best hope is that some, you know, kind of intervening event changes the climate for them and improves it. Right now, things just are looking bad on all fronts.
Janet, thanks very much for being with us today.
Sure, Tom.
Jack Beatty's been riding along with us here, and right now joining us from Washington is Chuck Todd, editor-in-chief of National Journal's Hotline. It's a daily online political newsletter published out of Washington. He's been watching all this very closely. Chuck Todd, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
So here we are, these brand new numbers from the Wall Street Journal, NBC, just worse from worse to worse to worse for the GOP and President Bush. What do I see here? The lowest voter approval of Congress fallen to 16% from 20%. Disapproval of Congress has risen to 75% from 65%. At the top level, do these numbers present an unsurmountable challenge for the GOP, or is it still that state-by-state battle?
Well, you know, I did a column this week that literally sat there and said, because I wanted to just sort of lock myself in a room in my office and said, okay, five reasons why this thing is like 1994 and five reasons why it's not. And the fact is, it's the answer to your question is yes to both, okay? It's insurmountable at this point. It seems insurmountable. That said, the Republicans are much better prepared for what's about to hit them than the Democrats were in 1994. And what does that mean? Well, that could mean the difference between losing five seats and six seats in the Senate. That's the difference possibly in losing 16 seats versus 30 seats in the House. And so, you know, that's sort of where I feel like that the ranges we're dealing with now. I mean, it almost seems impossible how the Republicans hold the House. And you almost wonder if the National Party is almost focused solely on trying to keep their grip on the Senate, because just holding one at this point, the way expectations are, would actually be seen as a moral victory for the Republicans.
Hanging on to the Senate, even if just by one seat, where do you see the fiercest contest at this point?
I think the battle for the Senate, probably the four closest races appears to be Missouri, Tennessee, New Jersey, and Virginia. And then I always put an asterisk on Rhode Island because, honestly, in the Senate, Rhode Island up there, will they vote their conscience or their party? I mean, I think that, you know, people up there in Rhode Island believe that Lincoln Chafee and Sheldon Whitehouse are the same person. They just know Chafee better, except the other guy's the Democrat. I mean, it's very – so that race really – boggles my mind. I just can't get my arms around it because it's not normally nationalized the way these other ones are.
President out today on the stump for George Allen in Virginia and also for Don Sherwood, saying, you know, we're all sinners, never mind the extramarital affair. Forgiveness is in order here. Are there still spots where the president can deliver support for
Absolutely.
These candidates?
Absolutely. I think that what you're looking at is a base strategy by the Republicans at this point. This is about they're going to selectively send the president to places where there still is a solid 40 to 45% Republican base vote. And I mean by Republican base vote, these are people that would, you know, turn out, you know, rain, sleet, snow, you know, type of voters. And I think that, they are there. They're in Richmond, Virginia. They are in these sort of exurban parts of the Philadelphia, you know, don't forget this is more Scranton up there. They exist there. So, and I think that you will see them being sent selectively to some of these places because you can get, you know, the folks that will show up to these events, they're the folks that you want to have making your phone calls. They're the folks that you want door knocking. And that's how the 72-hour program that the Republicans have put in place works.
This is fire up the absolute core troops because they've got a big challenge here, and maybe they can step up to it. Let's turn to one of those most hotly contested key races in deciding if the majority leaves the GOP or not. Of course, Tennessee, one that you mentioned. Jacqueline Fellows joins us from WPLN, Nashville Public Radio. She's reported on the race for the U.S. Senate in Tennessee between Democrat Harold Ford Jr. and Republican Bob Corker. Jacqueline Fellows, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
First of all, introduce us to these two men. Who do you have slugging it out to the finish line here?
This race really is a toss-up. I mean, we had three polls released within days of each other a couple of weeks ago, and all of the polls showed them either in a statistical dead heat or Harold Ford Jr. Slightly ahead. Now, Bob Corker ran for the Senate in 1994. He lost that GOP primary to now Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. A year later, he was the state's finance commissioner for a year and a half and then took a small break from politics until 2001 when he served as mayor of Chattanooga for one four-year term. But you don't see him playing up his political experience. You really see him playing up his business experience. He was a small business owner who had a construction company, started in his 20s, grew it, sold it. And that's what he's really touting to voters in to set himself apart from Harold Ford Jr., who is young, comes from this very powerful, politically connected Memphis family.
Harold Ford Jr., of course, entering Congress in 1997 at the age of 26, very early, right out of the blocks, and positioning himself or trying to very hard as a Democrat, but a very moderate Democrat.
Right. And what Corker is trying to do in this campaign is he's trying to portray Ford as the most liberal person in Tennessee's congressional delegation, which, you know, you have to question how much does that say, because Tennessee's congressional delegation is for the most part moderate. And Tennessee has a long history of sending moderates to elected offices. But this is the one place where Corker is trying to, again, like Missouri, Tennessee's race is a toss-up. It's going to come down to voter turnout. So Corker has to really appeal to that Republican base and not to everybody as a moderate.
Let's listen in to just a little bit of a debate on October 10th at the University of Chattanooga. We'll hear Bob Corker respond, but Harold Ford Jr. talking first about working across party lines.
If you want someone who will look a Democrat in the eye and say you're wrong, if you want someone who will look a Republican in the eye and say you're right, if you want someone to look a Democrat in the eye when he or she's right and say, you know what, I'm with you, or a Republican in the eye when they're wrong and tell them the same, I'm asking for your vote and your prayers in this race, because the good Lord knows if there's anything we need more of in Washington, it's a group of adults who are willing to sit down, recognize our challenges, and work through them to solve them. I've done it for 10 years in the Congress. And by the way, they do all this talking about me being liberal. I was the one that ran against Nancy Pelosi to be the leader of the Democrats because I believe there's a better way, a more rational way, a way where you reach out to Democrats in your party who are conservative, and you even reach out to Republicans who want to pass sound and good legislation.
Mr. Corker? Thank you. Well, I know my opponent talks a great deal about being independent. I just want to make sure that everyone knows that 88% of the time he votes like Ted Kennedy and Hillary Clinton. So it's not quite as independent as you might think. All of my life, I've worked right here in Chattanooga in this state to really bring people together to solve problems. I did that as a mayor here in the community and put tremendous energy out. And I think you saw that even when issues were difficult to deal with, I stayed the course.
Chattanooga Mayor Bob Corker there, a candidate for the U.S. Senate to take Bill Frist's seat, responding to Harold Ford Jr.'s characterization of himself as a big-time moderate. Let's go right down to Tennessee. Maria is calling from Nashville. Hi, Maria. You're on the air. What do you see in your race there?
Hi. Well, we see lots of people volunteering out there for Harold Ford Jr. A lot of people who were Bush supporters two times in a row that are just ready for change and ready for maturity in Washington.
But it's neck and neck, we're told, in the polls for all that effort. What do you see driving this race? What's going to determine it in these last few weeks, Maria, from your perspective?
Energy. We've got so much energy. We live, of course, Nashville is blue, you know, has voted consistently blue. But right outside Nashville, you've got all of these middle, upper-income counties, and we're in one of those donut counties around Davidson County. People want change. It doesn't matter what their pet issue is. They see Republicans in charge for 6 years, White House, Senate, Congress. What have they gotten done? And they want something different there. Harold Ford Jr. has all the new smart ideas that we need in Washington. He just needs to be in the party in power to get it to happen.
So there's a thumbs up for the Democratic candidate in this race. Maria, thanks for your call. Jacqueline Fellows, how about it? When the rubber meets the road on the organization side, does the GOP have the machine to help pull this out for Corker?
Well, when the polls came out and Corker was shown as trailing, he made some big changes in his campaign. So that told us that he was reacting to those polls. What he did is he brought in Tom Ingram, who is Senator Lamar Alexander's chief of staff, to come in and kind of shake things up. Tom Ingram is a veteran of Tennessee politics. He knows how things shake out. And what you've seen since they've taken over is you have seen Corker slightly repositioning himself. He is more available to the public. He is campaigning more in West Tennessee. He's got a new image on his website that is not your typical red, white, and blue. Hi, I'm here, vote for me. Mm. It's more of an understated, you know, the real Tennessean. It's again, Corker trying to set himself apart as a Washington outsider who can really get things done. But Maria is right. Harold Ford Jr.'s campaign has really been out from the beginning. Harold Ford didn't face any real competition in a primary. Bob Corker had a very competitive primary that he had to fight against and had a lot of energy going to that election and came out having to fight, keep fighting, and fight against Harold Ford Jr. even while he was in the primary.
Jacqueline,
so it really is going to come out to turnout.
What about the race factor here? Harold Ford Jr. from a very prominent African-American family. Does it play in? Is Tennessee past that? How's that play through?
Well, one analyst I had talked to had put it to me in these terms. He said that if he wouldn't discount race anywhere in the South in an election, but if he was going to discount it anywhere, it would be here in Tennessee because we don't have the same sort of raucous history that other Southern states have. You don't see race playing a big part here. I mean, in the way that one way that I guess it is playing is African Americans are expected to turn out in big numbers for Harold Ford Jr. He's energetic. He's well known. He's been out there campaigning. They're proud to have somebody go to the U.S. Senate. If he's elected, from Tennessee, he'd be the first black elected to a statewide office in history here, the first black elected to the Senate since Reconstruction. So that's a big deal. They're proud of him. They're expected to come out in really big numbers.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in this Ford-Corker race in Tennessee?
Well, I'm interested in hearing something about Corker's troubles. As I understand it, he really bruised feelings in that primary, that some of his ads were wildly unfair to his opponents. I think there were two congressmen. And that really has sowed bad feelings in the Republican base. Is that does that jibe with what you've been hearing out there, Jacqueline?
Well, the two congressmen that you mentioned he ran against in the primary were Ed Bryant and Van Hillary. And it was a pretty bloody primary. Ed Bryant and Van Hillary and Bob Corker all trying to position themselves as the most conservative person who can get out there and vote. Corker's ads were negative. They were criticized. He was criticized for having a negative campaign. What you hear, though, is not so much that what I hear from voters is not so much that they're mad at Bob Corker, so they're not going to go out and vote. If they're not going to go out and vote, or they might vote for Harold Ford Jr., it has less to do with Corker being mean to his opponents, so to speak, in the primary than it does with just the general malaise of, like, the rest of the country with the president's approval ratings and the war in Iraq. So you don't see that playing a lot out here in Tennessee, not among voters.
Jacqueline Fellows at WPLN in Nashville, Nashville Public Radio. Jacqueline, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
We turn next to New Jersey and the race there between the Democratic incumbent, Robert Menendez, and the Republican challenger, Thomas Kean Jr., challenger. Chuck Todd, set this up for us. What's going on here?
Well, I think you have this is a race that's big, where you have the two candidates. One is trying to make it about the incumbent, and the other is trying to make it about national issues. And, you know, what's going to happen? I mean, you know, the troubles that Democrats have had with ethical issues over the last, I would argue, 6 years in New Jersey have yet to punish the Democratic Party. They always seem, you know, no matter what's happened, whether it's Torricelli, whether it's the McGreevy stuff, and people forget that the McGreevy resigned for office not because he was gay, but because he was having ethical shenanigans happening in his administration. The Corzine stuff, and Menendez. So you wonder, is the weight of this just too much for Menendez to overcome, particularly when you're running against a Republican like Tom Kaine Jr., who just has a golden name? I mean, Tom Kaine Sr. Is probably, in many the minds of many New Jersey voters, the last guy that really classed up the place. He just was has an impeccable reputation among Democrats and Republicans. Will that reputation transfer to Jr.? I think it has to a point, but I'll tell you, at the end of the day, I just don't know if the National Republicans are going to spend the money that it takes to win this thing, because they look at New Jersey and they think it's like Charlie Brown, Lucy, and the football. Every time they go and make a run at New Jersey, the Democrats just snatch the football away. So.
And yet they really need it this time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's listen to just a little bit of tape from a debate this week on New Jersey radio station 101.5 FM out of Trenton. Here's Menendez and Kaine. First, Menendez talking about responding to a question about the minimum wage.
Luckily, Democrats in New Jersey raised the minimum wage that just went into effect recently to $7.15 an hour. My opponent, Tom Kaine Jr., when he had the chance to help people in the state be able to lift themselves out of poverty, because those people who work at the minimum wage and work 35, 40 hours, some of the toughest jobs in our state, voted against raising the minimum wage. I think he's out of touch with the realities of people in the state who work hard and are trying to realize the hopes and dreams and aspirations of their families. And when you vote against the minimum wage, it's simply wrong.
Mr. Kaine.
Okay, well then, Bob, I guess you're wrong, because you voted against the minimum wage at the federal level. You had the chance. It passed the House on a bipartisan basis to have a federal minimum wage of $7.25 when you were in the Senate. You voted, said that shouldn't even be considered for action. I urged you over the course of that entire week when that bill was coming across to support the federal minimum wage, because I thought it was an important vote to have and support a federal minimum wage. We could have had it done on a bipartisan basis. It fell a few votes shy. You opposed that effort because it included efforts, including tax cuts for individuals who were hired off of the welfare rolls, which is part of the tax bill package. I think we could have had a federal minimum wage. If you had been willing to reach across the partisan aisle to get it done, we could have had a federal minimum wage of $7.25. We don't, Bob, because of your inability to reach across the partisan line.
Here's a Democratic Senate incumbent in trouble in New Jersey, Robert Menendez, staring there at State Senator Thomas Kaine Jr. Josh Golke joins us from Bergen, New Jersey. He's a political reporter at the Bergen Record. Josh, what do you see in the polls right now? Who's ahead in this one?
Hi, Tom. Hi. This race has been really close for a few months. There have been some really slight signs in the past couple weeks that it is starting to move in Bob Menendez's direction.
Right now, Caesar's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Caesar. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you all doing? I've been enjoying listening to the program. I just wanted to share with you the fact that I don't believe that the Democrats are going to take control of the Senate or the House, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
They have the person that frames the argument wins the argument. And not only have the Republicans framed the argument, they framed the argument, they've put in place the language and the vocabulary, and the Democrats have done nothing to counter that or to frame their own argument or their own language. You hear even the Democrats use stay the course.
Caesar, let me ask you about that. We heard a lot about that after the last election round, the presidential election. But with so many events here now, you've got this, any number of scandals. You've got Iraq being what it is. Is framework still all powerful when events rear their head in this way?
Framework is still all powerful because they keep mending the framework. Because you've now heard one of your last pollsters indicated that the voters have gone from, yes, we should be into Iraq, to it was wrong for us to be there, but now we've got to stay the course and win the race. And that's still the Republicans subtly tweaking the argument to make it their own, and they control it. And I got to tell you, on just looking at it, you know, Ross and Democrats collectively come across as very weak, very indecisive, and they say, okay, Bush is wrong. Okay, he's wrong. Yeah, well, what's your alternative?
Caesar, let us pick that up, and I'll take it right to Josh Gokey, who's watching a Democrat fight for his seat in New Jersey. How about it, Josh? The framework of the debate, does Bob Menendez seem comfortable with it? Does he seem empowered by it? Or is he still facing some kind of GOP advantage in the way issues are put together, framed up here?
Well, I think New Jersey is an anomaly on a national scale, but certainly Bob Menendez has been very eager to make this race about national issues, and he seems quite comfortable with the way issues are being framed nationally. He's been very eager to make this about the war in Iraq. On the other hand, Tom Kaine Jr. has been trying to make it about Menendez, and in New Jersey, the scandals we talk about are those involving the Democrats, and that's what Tom Kaine Jr. wants to talk about.
What does Kaine say about Iraq? Does he use the phrase, stay the course?
No, he's been pretty good at avoiding that phrase. You hear that phrase most often from Menendez. Kaine has taken great pains to criticize the war as much as he can. He's called for Donald Rumsfeld's resignation. The only part of the Bush line that he's hewed to has been that he would have voted for the invasion and that he opposes withdrawal deadlines. But other than that, he's been quick to criticize the war effort.
Josh Gokey with the Bergen Record in Bergen, New Jersey. Josh, thanks very much for your report there. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So we're going to go to Montana in just a moment, but let's hear from a couple more callers to, if I may, Alexandria, Virginia, and pick up a call there. John, hi, you're on the line and on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Say, we are big supporters of Jim Webb in Alexandria and throughout Virginia, and we're supporting him because he has, from before day one of the Iraq invasion, been opposed to the war. And when he goes to the Senate, he is going to propose that the countries in the region, in the Middle East region, get behind the stabilization of the region and withdraw in a systematic way our troops from Iraq.
Sounds like you're solid on the website there. Do you think George Bush can help swing it to George Allen with his visit there today?
I think George Bush, every time he steps in the Virginia, is going to cause Mr. Allen to go down another notch or two.
Chuck Todd, let's pick that up. What about the Jim Webb, military man Jim Webb, George Allen with all kinds of troubles in the last couple of months here? How do you think that's ultimately going to swing on the allegations of all kinds of misstatements, to say the least, around the edges or on Iraq at the heart of it? Where?
Well, I've actually been recusing myself on this race. I have a personal conflict of this in my family when it comes to this race.
You've got someone working for Webb or Allen?
Working for Webb, so I try to stay away from it.
I bet you do.
Per se, but I'll do a big picture in this because I think it pertains to all the competitive Senate races that are taking place in red states. The key to all the Democrats' chances in all these places, will the blue areas of some of these red states like Virginia, Tennessee, and Missouri, do they become dark blue? Does Democratic turnout in these metro urban areas like Northern Virginia, like the St. Louis suburbs, does it overwhelm normal turnout figure? And I think that if they do, and that's what a lot of predicting with the Virginia race, with the Missouri race, then all of a sudden you can't, you know, normal polling doesn't apply, normal turnout models for the Republicans don't apply. And I think that's sort of a key question mark in a lot of these races.
Jack Beatty, and what do you think about the issues versus mud? And here's a case. We've got serious questions about Iraq. At the same time, George Allen is fighting off allegations of what he said in 1970, I don't know what. How do you see issues versus heat in this year's campaigns?
Well, there's a lot of negative ads out there, and I see from a study at the University of Missouri that just came out that positive ads are remembered more by people. That's counterintuitive, but it has to do with the speed of the ad, that the percussive beat of the negative ad, it goes through people, whereas the slower positive ad, they remember. Now, is that going to work out? Are negative ads going to backfire? I don't know. One thing they do is they drive independents away from the polls. They discourage the good government voter. They just don't go. And so that in a way, negative ads, if you're in a base election, negative ads can help you because it drives down the people who aren't in the base. It's hard to imagine a politician who had as bad a run of really bigoted statements as this man had, Allen had, in September. It's going to be kind of a black eye if the guy gets reelected because of his he came very close to sort of the outliers of what you can say in American politics, it seems to me. And very credible people came forward, physicians and others, to say this is the way he talked when he was in college. So it'll be something to see there.
Close to a flame-out, but still hanging in. Let's take a call from Bowie, Maryland. Ade is on the line. Hi, Ade.
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I just want to first say I do really enjoy your show, and thanks for what you're doing. But my main problem, like in my state, Maryland, we're having election of a Senate between Michael Steele, the lieutenant governor, and Ben Cardin. And as I was saying earlier, I just think it's annoying because all the ads are just negative ads. No one is talking about the points. No one is talking about what they want to do in regarding health care, the war in Iraq, or anything at all. It's just my opponent says this, my opponent says that. And it's so sad that that's what American politics has come to.
Like, do you perceive a difference on policy, even if they're not talking about it? Do you feel it under the covers, Ade?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, no one knows. I'm a Democrat. I'm a registered Democrat. But I don't even know what Ben Cardin wants to do because, funny enough, he's now following in the footsteps of his opponent. I mean, all your ads are just negative ads. You say this, even in the gubernatorial.
No, we hear it. They're working on your nerve endings and everybody else's. What the right balance is always an open question. I want to get one more state into this conversation before our time winds down. I want to turn to Montana. Sally Mock joins us there. She's news director from Montana Public Radio. She's been reporting on the hot race for the U.S. Senate between Republican incumbent Conrad Burns and Democratic challenger John Tester. Sally, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Now, this is one that was very close, and now we're seeing people push it over into the Democratic win column here. Does it look like Tester's got it wrapped up? Is it still an open game?
Well, I wouldn't say it's wrapped up. Races in Montana are hardly ever wrapped up. Tester does have an 11-point lead in the latest poll taken this week.
That's pretty strong.
And, that's a pretty good gap. But it does depend on, as many of your callers have said today, on turnout. And Senator Burns, it should be noted, the last time he was up for re-election was trailing in the polls on the eve of the election and pulled it out. So I don't think Tester's taking it for granted, and none of his supporters are either.
It's been a colorful race. Scandal has been a big issue in this race. Let's listen to just a moment. Here's a debate in Billings, Montana, October 17th. You've got Burns and Tester. Tester asks Burns about his relationship to convicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff.
Senator Burns, how is it that all of your friends are under investigation, and when will you start being accountable for the actions of your friends?
John, you've dribbled this thing out for the last 18 months. Every time I turn around, you got it dribbling out there. And there's nothing there. Nothing there.
I think it's important, if there's nothing there, why did you spend $27,000 last month for your criminal defense attorney?
Sally Mock, you guys know how to make colorful debate in Montana. Is the scandal issue still driving Montanans in their view of this race, or are they looking at other issues as their primary considerations?
Mm-hmm. It is one factor for sure. I think the Abramoff scandal sort of gave Democrats a toehold in this race. But Senator Burns has also made some gaffes during the campaign that have hurt him. Most notably, he chewed out some firefighters in a Montana airport who had been flown in to help fight a fire in eastern Montana. And he had talked to some disgruntled ranchers and sort of took out their anger on these firefighters. And in Montana, firefighters are right up there with soldiers. I mean, people have great respect for them, and they thought the senator had gone over the top on that. So that hurt him. And being tied to a general disenchantment with Republicans nationally, I think all those things are adding up. The Abramoff scandal sort of started to chip away at the senator's support here, but it's several things I think are coming together to make this a really tough race for him.
What else? Beyond scandal, what's working well for Tester? What's worked for Burns? What are the strengths and vulnerabilities on the issues?
Well, for Tester, I think personality and his background are helping him. He's an organic farmer. In Montana, agriculture is still our number one industry. Mm. He's a likable guy, a former school music teacher as well, and has some political experience in the state Senate. Moderate Democrat, probably, even though Senator Burns tries to portray him as liberal. He's against gun control. He's against gay marriage. A lot of the hot-button issues Republicans mm-hmm. like to run on, they can't run against Tester on that. Senator Burns is running on his ability to bring home the bacon and likes to point out that he's brought over $2 billion to Montana during his three terms in the Senate. And so he's running on the seniority issue, and that has an impact on people. They do know that the senator has brought a lot of money to Montana.
And in spite of that, right now, as you say, an 11-point lead for Tester, but Conrad Burns has come from behind in the vote before. Jack, do you have a question for Sally there?
Well, I was just wondering about this latest statement from the latest debate where Burns says that President Bush has a secret plan to get us out of Iraq, but he can't tell that to Tester because Tester would blab it and the enemy would learn it. What's been the reaction to this astounding secret plan statement out there?
Sally?
Well, the senator is known for saying things off the cuff that maybe don't have a lot of logic behind it at the moment. And I think, you know, people think in some ways in Montana that that's just Conrad being Conrad. He's also said in an interview with me that he thinks Iraq was behind 9/11. And a lot of things like that, I think, don't affect his base, but probably affect independent voters in Montana.
A secret plan, quite secret at the moment. Sally Mockett, Montana Public Radio in Missoula, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Let me get one more call. Amy in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I love listening to your show. I'm calling as a Rhode Island Democrat, and earlier someone on your show had sort of said that this was an easy race. And I have to say, for Rhode Islanders, that's actually not true at all. The thing is, we love Link Chafee in Rhode Island.
Very moderate Republican.
He's a very moderate Republican, and he votes the conscience of Rhode Islanders, and that's a wonderful thing. But many Rhode Islanders don't want Republicans to maintain control of the House either.
So what are you going to do, Amy?
I don't know, and I was actually really curious if some people on your show might actually have something to say about this. The candidates, we love Link Chafee, and I think a moderate voice needs to be rewarded in the Senate. But I also know that I'd really like to see Democrats take control of the House. If I vote for Chafee, will that happen?
Amy wants to know. Hey, let us pick it up. Our time is short. Chuck Todd, what about this Chafee White House race? You hear Amy's question, what to do?
Our spotlight today is called the Forgotten Toss-Up, Rhode Island Senate, because it is a race that in some ways it's defying the national landscape because you don't have a Republican who's trying to defend the Bush administration.
Mm-hmm. It's all about the majority, really.
It really is. Both guys are mirror images of each other on issues. Their kids go to the same private school. They're the same guy. You know, they probably belong to the same country clubs. They're probably friends or have mutual friends with each other. Rhode Island's a small state, so everybody mm-hmm. knows each other. I'll tell you, it's an enigma wrapped in a conundrum wrapped in an enigma, something like that.
In a mystery off in the fog. It sounds like you don't have a clear guidance for Amy there, and how could you?
Yeah, no, it should be the Democrats should win this. You know what it might be like? Texas governor, 1994. Ann Richards, George W. Bush, both had 60% favorable ratings, and what happened at the end of the day? They went with their party. Gut says they probably go with their party in this one, but
you know, we wouldn't be shocked with either result.
Jack Beatty, we just got half a minute here. House very likely going Democrat. Senate still teetering here. What's at stake? If it goes or not, let's say, you know, both houses to Democrats or one to Democrats, how do you see the ultimate stakes in that difference?
I think it matters for the war. I mean, I think that if the Democrats win either house, the message will be sent the war is not a politically saving issue, and that politicians get that, and that the survival instinct will set in, and that we will have a more rapid withdrawal from Iraq than otherwise.
So there's one great big piece in play in all these races and what they add up to. Chuck Todd, editor-in-chief at National Journal's Hotline. Chuck, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for the invitation.
Jack, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.